It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania's natural gas boom is bad news for Russia. Can they undercut our state's industry, or have they been doing it for years already? Why run for school board if you're not going to show up for a third or even a half of the meetings? And the Republican nominee for governor has resigned his Senate seat to focus on his effort to unseat the Democrat incumbent. Those stories coming up. But first, demonstrations by NFL players during the national anthem have been making headlines for the better part of 2 years, led at first by then San Francisco quarterback Colin Kaepernick. The on-field protest of police brutality and treatment of black men spread, resulting in multiple teams acting in tandem during games last year. President Trump rekindled public reaction this week. We're going to talk politics, patriotism, the national anthem, and the social justice issue at the heart of the protest with Sean Gentile, sports writer with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the program, Sean.
Kevin, glad to be back.
And on the line is Steve Essick, reporter covering politics and government for the Morning Call of Allentown. Hello, Steve.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And your comments and questions are encouraged. Email confluence@wesa.fm. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So early this week, President Trump announced he was withdrawing an invitation for the Super Bowl champs, the Philadelphia Eagles, to visit the White House. Steve, pardon the pun, and explain for us this latest political football.
I'm sorry, Kevin. Was that to me?
Yes, please.
Yeah. So the Eagles won the first Super Bowl in Philadelphia history this year, and as such, it was always the debate of whether anybody's going to go to the White House. And that is not because of the players put themselves in that position. That's because, as you alluded to, Donald Trump, for the better part of 2 years on the campaign trail, also was critical of players taking a knee during the anthem. So the Eagles were scheduled to go, and there's mixed reports out there, and it looks like, you know, at first not too many Eagles were going to go. The White House says 81 were going to go. I find that hard to believe, given the fact that a lot of the players, you know, who would go to go see somebody who's going to threaten your livelihood? I didn't think any of those players were going to go. Donald Trump obviously pulled the plug in a very public tweet. That tweet, in my opinion, as a political reporter, backfired. The Philadelphia Eagles players really stood up and went to Twitter, too, and fired back at the president. They also fired back at the late-night Fox News hosts who tend to back Donald Trump policies and that sort of thing, when they erroneously showed pictures of players praying, kneeling in prayer, and they alluded to the fact that they were allegedly kneeling in protest, which was not the case.
Right, they were. There was a pre-game kneeling for a prayer, correct?
Yes, that is correct, and they showed a lot of pictures of that, and they kept showing them and showing them until the Eagles players took to Twitter to denounce Fox News hosts as propagandists for the president. Fox News then apologized, and then you know, the whole thing went extremely viral, and I think you know, I gathered a lot of it was negative toward the president.
Okay. Now, Sean, you have I want your perspective from across the state, because you've also covered White House visits, most recently, of course, the Penguins. What has been your take on what's happened this week involving the White House, President Trump, the Philly Eagles?
Oh, I think generally a big takeaway for me is that the NFL continues to misunderstand, I think, the basic nature of Donald Trump, and B, what he's trying to accomplish with the anthem issue. I think he realizes it's political red meat and is using it as such, and to expect any sort of intellectual honesty from him on this is folly. So you have the NFL owners who continue to hope that they're going to figure out some way to defuse it, and he continues to just, you know, bring it up at every occurrence, really. So Yeah, I think that's what it's about. It's just this ongoing war between Trump and the NFL, really, and it's for solely political reasons. And if you want to be cynical about it, and I think this is just the latest example of it.
Well, I think it's more. I think it's more than that. I covered five to six Donald Trump rallies during the campaign and afterwards, and he uses this issue as a as political fodder for his supporters. He would mention this. He would use code words. He used before he really focused on the anthem. He focused on just protests across the nation and into police brutality. And he would bring those things up at the campaigns rallies, and a vast majority of the people there loved it. And Donald Trump knows they loved it, so he then took that issue, which kind of died in the streets, and brought it to the NFL and started criticizing the players over it because he knows that it gets the same amount of legs for his supporters. However, I do think he, you know, misjudged who he tried to do that to. I mean, this Philadelphia Eagles team, like I said, won the Super Bowl for the first time in Philadelphia. I had to cover the plane landing at Philadelphia Airport the next day after they beat the Patriots. And the amount of joy, love, I mean, excitement, relief that was in the air was palpable. And I think that continues for the fan base there. And this issue could have legs in the upcoming election, I think. And it's not that anybody would vote for or against a candidate because of what Donald Trump says on this. However, I do think that candidates or their opponents can add on to this as pro or Donald Trump. It's part of that narrative that is part of the national political environment right now, and it could have legs in Southeast PA for Republicans and Democrats alike.
Okay, so I guess the question is, and you alluded to it briefly there, Steve, is do fans really care about whether their team goes to the White House? I want to get your reactions, but first let's hear from a couple of Eagles fans.
They didn't want to go anyway, okay, most of them. So my thing, I don't care about, you know, they don't care about them not getting invited because they didn't want to go anyway.
When you're invited by the President of the United States to celebrate being the Super Bowl champs, you should honor his respect and go.
All right, Sean, let's start with you. When you've been, do the fans care, Sean, whether the team goes to the White House anymore?
That's a tough question. I think it's split. It's split down partisan lines, just like a lot of things. And we saw that when we dealt with the Penguins, you know, earlier this year. They did go. They decided as a team. They took pains to try to make it as apolitical as possible. But you know, you can call something apolitical and say that you're not taking a stance. But you know, the reality of the situation is that everything is politics. Everything is political. And in choosing to go does say something to some extent. But yeah, the response to that really here, speaking again about the Penguin situation, is it was across the board. Absolutely, I think there are a lot of people who don't care, but then there are also a lot of people who are firmly on either side. I think it's a mixed bag, and I think it's divided pretty clearly by your support for the president or lack of support, really.
And Steve, what's your sense in talking to people? Did they want the Eagles to go to the White House, a sense of pride, or was the victory parade and the welcome at the airport enough for the fans?
I think for the most part, that was enough for the fans. I mean, a championship team in any sport going to the White House was used to be just a photo op that only the local paper would tend to cover, right? Or ESPN would show some sort of quick little tidbit that some college team or some pro team got their picture with the president, and that was it. However, Donald Trump, being Donald Trump, has turned it into more than that, and he's turned it into an us versus them mentality, and he loves it, and that's part of it. But it's beyond politics. To me, it's sort of like, would anybody go to a neighbor's house if he kept calling your kids ugly? You know, he kept calling your wife ugly or your husband ugly. I mean, it's kind of like, why would you go to somebody's house who constantly tears you down? It doesn't seem like he wants you there, and I don't know why anybody would want to go, whether it's
right.
The president or your neighbor who's saying nasty stuff about you.
And also the goalposts on on whether it's Trump or his supporters or whatever, the goalposts on the issue are moving. Like, it's clearly not about kneeling for the anthem. I mean, we see that with the Eagles. They didn't have a single player who did. They had players like Chris Long and Malcolm Jenkins and up and down the list who were, you know, who were educated and vocal and smart and strategic in the way they approach things. But those guys were not kneeling for the anthem. And I think we're seeing it again with the NBA. I mean, just today, Trump said that he wasn't going to invite the Cavs or the Warriors, who had already said that they wouldn't accept an invitation.
So both teams said,
yeah, right.
Said that.
So there's an element of, you know, you're not, you don't want to come to my party. Well, you weren't going to be invited anyway. But no, the NBA kneeling or standing for the anthem is mandatory, and no NBA player at any point has offered any sort of response to the anthem other than standing there silently and quietly. So this clearly isn't about what players do or don't do during the anthem. It's mushroomed into something much, much larger than that. And I think that's an example of the cynicism on Trump's side, the way that we talked about before.
I agree with all that. And in the blog post I've written on it, I've pointed out that Donald Trump failed to go to the Vietnam War or go into the draft 5 different times. So regardless of whether he is president or not, if he is going to create his stamp of patriotism, then I think every news outlet in America, right, left, down the middle, should be pointing out the fact that he hasn't always been as patriotic as he claimed. And then he stood there on national TV at his own military, you know, concert and didn't know the words to one of the most iconic songs in America. So, you know, he created the mess, and I think it backfired on him.
And that's a level of dissonance that just doesn't matter with people who support him. If we're being honest about it, they understand that on some level. They realize that he got medical deferments and he doesn't know the words of God Bless America, and that the goalposts keep moving, and they don't expect intellectual honesty out of it, and they don't necessarily care, because if they did care, their response to all this stuff, all these contradictions would be a lot different.
All right, we have just a minute left, gentlemen. I want to get to this very quickly, and that was at the owners' meeting earlier this spring. It seemed to me like the protests during the anthem were actually fading toward the end of the year. And then the NFL sort of stirred it up again by voting, and I use that term loosely, on a policy. Well, you can stay in the locker room if you want during the national anthem, but if you're out on the sideline, stand at attention. So 1 minute left. What are each of you expecting when the new football season starts? 1 minute left, Steve. 30 seconds for you, please.
Well, I expect nothing to happen. You know, if the owners were serious, they would close the concession stands, as some of the players pointed out. That's just what I think. I just think it'll fade away if the president allows it to, but I doubt he will.
All right, and Sean?
I totally agree. I think the response is a pretty classic splitting the baby situation, where the NFL somehow made a decision that didn't serve their purpose in any way and annoyed everybody on either side of the issue. And it's because they're afraid of Donald Trump. I mean, like, there's more than enough reports out there that the owners were terrified of this happening again. And I think that's sort of where this decision was born out of. So it's I don't expect it to end because I don't think Trump is going to let it end.
All right. Sean Gentile is a sports writer with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Steve Essick is a reporter covering politics and government for the Morning Call of Allentown. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Certainly.
And we're back with The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 45 years ago, the LGBT community in Pittsburgh held its first Pride March. Participants started in Market Square, making their way to Flagstaff Hill in Oakland. This year's Pride Week festivities wrap up this weekend. We're going to talk about those and how a rift among community leaders about the group that organizes Pittsburgh's Pride celebration has resulted in parallel marches for another year. Ryan Dito is a reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. He joins us in studio right now. Welcome back, Ryan.
I'm glad to be here.
And if you have a question or comment, email confluence@wesa.fm. Tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, thousands are expected to pour into the city this weekend for performances, speakers, vendors, para-marches. Ryan, you and your colleagues at City Paper, you've been reporting on this annual event through the years. It's taking on many faces, a protest, an event to raise awareness about a variety of issues, and ultimately a celebration of people living authentically. What's Pride today?
Well, Pride today is a multitude of things. I think to a lot of people, it's a lot of different things. That's what we tried to do in our issue of City Paper this week. Our Pride issue of City Paper is get as many as perspectives as we can. To some people, it's a celebration. It's all about being out, being happy, being cheerful that they are allowed to be themselves, basically, out in the streets and to say, hey, we're here and this is who we are. To other people, it is a protest. It is a we've been oppressed, you know, to the you know, for the LGBT community. And they want to remind people that there's still ongoing issues being openly LGBT in America.
Who's the protest directed to? Delta Foundation or just an awareness thing to the greater Pittsburgh regional community?
That's a really good question, actually. I think some of the coverage we've done at the City Paper is there definitely has been a protest directed directly at, you know, at the Delta Foundation, the quote unquote largest, you know, LGBT, you know, community advocacy group,
right,
you know, in the region. And there's been some criticism that their focus is a little bit too much with cisgender white men, even, you know, even if they are gay men. And they want a little bit more inclusivity. They want to see some minority queer people, you know, at the table. They want to see trans people have a bigger say in some of these decisions about Pride. And but I would also say that I think this is also just a general frustration at maybe some of the lack of progress that still persists. There has been incredibly, you know, fast progress on some things, but you know, there's still a lot of counties, you know, in the state, for example, where you can be fired for being gay. So that's something that I think people might want to get the message out about.
Right. And of course, Pennsylvania does not have a statewide law
exactly
protecting gay, lesbians and transgender individuals in terms of employment and housing.
That's right.
All right. Let's hear from Ciara Thomas, founder of Sisters PGH, which has organized the People's Pride March. She spoke with WESA about the lack of inclusiveness.
The message we got last year is like, we have been waiting for something alternative to do because we're not serving or seeing the community we want to serve here. We're just really seeing predominantly cis white people at Pride Fest and drunk cis white people at that.
All right, Ryan. So has this criticism, as we mentioned, Delta has been organizing Pride Fest for, I believe, the last decade. Has this criticism of Delta and maybe a lack of inclusiveness within the LGBTQ community, Has it been bubbling, or is it really coming to a surface the last couple of years?
It's definitely been bubbling. This is something that within the community had been talked about for a very long time. You know, it really hit, I guess, openness, you know, in 2015, which was the first protest, which was called Roots Pride at that time.
Right.
And that was the first protest against the Delta Foundation that was kind of saying, hey, you're not as exclusive. Sorry. You know, you're not as inclusive as right. you should be. And but when we reported about that, you know, initially, that had really been something that a lot of people in the community were saying, well, we've been thinking about this for years and now's our time to do it. And it was definitely sparked by the choice of then rapper Iggy Azalea as the headliner. And, you know, Azalea had used a lot of slurs towards, you know, gay people in the past. And that was kind of like, well, you're not really, you know, our person, I guess.
Okay. Ryan, really quickly, in the minute and a half we have remaining, in this week's edition of City Paper, you say pride can mean many different things to many different people. But City Paper doesn't speak for the LGBTQ Pittsburghers. The paper published the insights of at least 8 different people. What stood out to you?
Really, the diversity, I guess. Like, there were people who were saying, we want this to be a protest. We want to keep that kind of fire to, you know, to make sure that we have the rights that we deserve. But also that people were saying, well, this is a party. And there are people who live in Mercer County or who live in, you know, Greene County that come to Pittsburgh and they just want to be able to be out and be in the streets and be able to say, hey, I'm gay and I want to be happy about it.
Mm-hmm. Was there one particular person that stood out to you? Were there their thoughts or...
Yeah, Brian.
Or were they, did they have a shared sort of a shared vision of what is happening?
I really like Brian Brooms, which was the you know, the first, you know, person we used, and you know, he's a writer from the North Side, and he's been involved in Pride for a long time, and his experience of the first Pride being booed and being heckled, you know, that he experienced, and then now to it's kind of like it's become a corporate party basically, and he's kind of like, I don't really know where I stand anymore in this Pride world, the kind of in between of, you know, of that initial protest to a big giant party. He doesn't really know what to do.
Ryan Dito is a reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. As always, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Coming up, absenteeism. Why is it so high? Not at the schools, but among school board members. That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Post-Gazette cartoonist Rob Rogers broke his silence this week, addressing the controversy after the newspaper went a week without publishing his work. He said he wasn't given a reason why his illustrations were killed and is taking vacation time. And the city kicked off its lineup of free outdoor summer concerts and movies. You can find the list of events at WESA.FM.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are 43 school districts in Allegheny County, each with its own board of education, unpaid volunteers who sought those elected positions. So who's showing up to do the work? Reporter Matt McKinney explored that question for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette this week. Welcome, Matt. Good to have you here.
Kevin, thanks for having me.
Your questions and comments are invited. Email to confluence at WESA.FM. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Matt, what led you to this deep dive into school board members' attendance? Were you covering a school board meeting? You said to yourself, where is everyone?
Yeah, it was there was another story I was working on, and that required me to go back through the minutes, and I saw that one of the members seemed to be absent fairly frequently, and so I wondered what it looked like elsewhere in the county.
Okay, so how much access to records did you have? How difficult was it to get those attendance records?
It varies from district to district. I would say for the most part, most of the school districts in the area are pretty good about posting their minutes. The ones that don't, we had to ask for them, but...
And what time frame were we talking about before? I want to get into the specifics of, you know, who didn't. Not so much the who, but the whys they're not showing up. But what was the time frame we're talking
sure.
about?
Sure. We went back to January 2016, so about 20 through last month, so about 24 months overall, which felt long enough. Not quite a term, but long enough to get a feel.
What's the average commitment in terms of meetings per month and, you know, time spent attending, preparing? Is it like a couple times a month they have formal meetings or what?
One board member told me it's, you know, it can be anywhere up to 45 to 50 hours a month. You've got your agenda meeting and then you got a voting meeting too, but then outside of that you've got committee meetings too, and so I think it varies from district to district, but okay. but it can be kind of a heavy lift sometimes.
In your story, you include a graphic of the top 15 or maybe the worst 15, if you prefer, in terms of attendance. Who were they? Give us an idea of who they were and why did they miss?
Well, so we the Duquesne School District, which is in receivership, a struggling school district, had, you know, I don't have the numbers right in front of me,
right.
But they had several members who missed at least a third of the meetings. One member who stepped down recently had missed at least 24 meetings in a row. The reasons vary. I mean, some have commitments with kids, sporting events, health problems. One board member had transportation problems, issues getting to the meetings.
Right.
So.
And I believe you reported that four of the 15 were from the Duquesne School District. But I do want to mention that it's not just, shall we say, the low income, the financially struggling districts. The lack of attendance or poor attendance among at least some board members, they go across the spectrum because I believe you also had some from or at least one from Fox Chapel. So you got a low income district, Duquesne, then you have a higher income district in Fox Chapel.
Absolutely. It's all across the board. I mean, one thing, though, that I do think is worth noting is that on the whole, attendance is pretty good across the board. I mean, you're talking almost 400 school board members across the county. This is only about 4% of the members who miss a quarter or more of the meetings.
Right. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, the perfect attendance award or close to it, Gateway School District board members had a combined, you report, 6 absences combined. And Clareton Board President Richard Livingston, he had an interesting comment for you. He missed only 2 meetings, I believe, in 16 years. He told you, quote, "You need to be there to understand what's going on." How did that resonate with you?
Some of the good government experts that we talked to said that exactly that. They echoed that you need to be there to do the work. School boards, they set the vision and goals for a district. They're in charge of hiring and evaluating superintendents. They oversee the budget. These jobs are they're unpaid and thankless a lot of times, but they've got big responsibilities too.
For board members who have a higher number of absences, what did they tell you in terms of, you know, how they keep abreast of the key issues, have the information?
Well, one board member in Woodland Hills told me that, you know, he doesn't deny that he misses meetings, but when he's not there, he's at his kids' sports events. And when he's there, he's talking to parents and he's getting kind of a feel for what the issues in the district are from a parent's view. When he's not there, he... still looking at the documents that were handed out. He's talking to his colleagues. He tries to keep up with what's going on when he's not there.
Very briefly, some of the ones that you talked to, did you say, well, Why do you stay on then if it's difficult to keep that commitment?
Well, right. I think that's the big question, and nobody seemed to have much of an answer for that. So
my final question to you is this, and we have about a minute left. I believe it was Gateway School Board's vice president who talked to you about a rarely invoked state law that gives districts the ability to remove a member if they skip consecutive meetings. Is it that easy, or is it not that easy?
The solicitor, Bruce Dice, who represents that district as well as a few others in the area, says it's tough. I mean, it sounds like there is it would be difficult to do. Because it would require a board to essentially turn on that member and
turn on one of their own.
Yeah, and I don't know that that's the way most boards would want to go about it. So
they wouldn't maybe mind somebody else removing them, but they don't want to be responsible
right.
for their colleague.
Right.
All right. Matt McKinney is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Check out his story at postgazette.com. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Pennsylvania's natural gas boom is bad news for Russia. Can they undercut the state's industry? That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, baseball player Josh Gibson hits what many believe is the world's longest home run when he slams a ball 580 yards nearly out of Yankee Stadium. Gibson played for the local Negro Leagues, the Pittsburgh Crawfords, and the Homestead Grays. He was the second African-American player to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Some people called him the Black Babe Ruth, while others called Ruth the White Josh Gibson. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for June 8th, 2018.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, a preview of an already contentious gubernatorial election. But first, what does Russian propaganda and energy dominance have to do with Pennsylvania? Investigative reporter Mike Wershagen put the pieces together for LNP Media in Lancaster this week. And for The Caucus, the print-only newspaper covering government and politics, Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Questions, comments, please email to confluence at WESA.fm. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Like Pennsylvania's natural gas output exploded in the last decade, making the Commonwealth second only to Texas in gas production. So we started exporting on a net basis, I believe, last year as a country. That's for the first time in about my lifetime. Mike, why does Russia care?
Well, Russia cares for a few reasons. One of them is that fossil fuel exports are kind of their bread and butter. That makes up a huge portion of the goods and services that they export overall. It's a big part of their economy. It's a big flow of cash into this country that really, really needs it. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that Russia is, though it's a huge place, their economy is smaller than Italy's.
Oh.
And so they are reliant on these fossil fuel exports. They need prices to be above a certain level. They need to be able to export it to certain areas. And that leads to a second reason why they care, and that is the power it gives them. Russia is the primary supplier of natural gas to Europe, and it gets pretty cold in parts of Europe.
Is this all of Europe or just Eastern Europe, your nearby neighbors? Or?
This is all of Europe. Mm. They go everywhere, and they go through Ukraine and Poland mostly, although there's another pipeline project in the works. But they do use that. They have used that in the past as kind of a political cudgel, as a way to project their power beyond what their economy would normally allow them to do. It's a really important tool for Vladimir Putin.
So if you want our gas, you do this? Is it that simple?
It's not exactly that simple, but, Ukraine runs into problems in the winter when they don't do things the Russians like.
All right. And, of course, the U.S. as a net exporter— in other words, exporting more than importing, that influences the price levels.
It does. It does. And less so the direct exports to Europe, because Europe's pretty far away and Russia's right there. So they're able to get it through in a pipeline. We need to liquefy it and stick it on boats and send it across the Atlantic. But yeah, by exporting, we then influence global prices, and it keeps things a little more stable. In the years since Pennsylvania's natural gas boom has occurred, global prices have not had the spikes that they used to have.
Okay, I'm going to follow up on that leverage point that you made. Is the U.S. wary of Russian dominance in the European energy market strictly in terms of economic competition or because of that potential political leverage?
It's both. It is economic competition, but it also is that political battle that has been, you know, taking place to one degree or another for quite some time now between, you know, the West and the East. And, you know, Russia, when the Obama administration took office and Pennsylvania's production really began to take off, which swelled total domestic production by quite a lot, his Secretary of State, President Obama's Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, almost immediately began going to these European countries, Eastern European countries, and bringing oil and gas executives with them.
Shell and others, Chevron, right, I believe.
Right, and telling them, look, you have this natural gas under your countries. You don't need to rely on Russia. You can do this yourselves, and we know how to do it. Let us show you.
Any of that come to fruition?
Some of it did, not to the extent that originally there was projected. I mean, part of it was because, say, under Poland, there was for a while there was assumed to be an awful lot of natural gas, and it turned out that much less of that was recoverable. But the other effect it had was making Vladimir Putin very nervous. All of a sudden, you had these Eastern Bloc countries, these former Soviet states and former Soviet republics and satellite countries who had still remained under Russia's influence even after the collapse of the Soviet Union because of their reliance on Russia for this energy. And all of a sudden, you had the United States moving in just as NATO was pushing closer and closer to their borders and saying, you don't need them anymore. You can do this yourselves. Come with us. We'll show you. And that kind of freaked him out.
In your story, your cover story, you point out that some of the concerns in Europe sounded a lot similar to some that are here in Pennsylvania. A lot of environmental protests, maybe, for instance. But at least here at home, we usually know who's behind the discontent, what their reasons are. In East European nations like Poland, for example, they're pointing the finger elsewhere.
Well, what happened was, and they are actually the same concerns and the same sorts of folks who have concerns about fracking here in the United States. There are environmental movements throughout Europe, but what surprised some of these Eastern European leaders was how quickly these organized protests sprang up and how well organized they are and how well funded they were. And nobody expected this level of opposition, and it seemed to come out of nowhere. And almost immediately, you had these leaders pointing the finger towards Russia and saying, you know, this is Moscow. This is them meddling in our local politics, which sounds a little more familiar today than it did back then.
And there was coverage of those incidents plus coverage of anything that might have gone wrong, maybe in Pennsylvania or in the U.S. by the cable network RT.
RT, right, which is an interesting outlet. They recently had to register as a foreign agent, under the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which is a federal law saying that if you're basically doing your work on behalf of another government to advance another government's interests, you got to tell the DOJ who you're working for. RT said, look, we're just an independent cable network. We cover news. We're journalists. The DOJ said, well, you're also essentially owned by Russia's state-run news agency. You are an organ of Vladimir Putin's government. So no, we want you to register. And RT covered a lot of these protests in Europe. And they began covering things like the Dakota Access Pipeline protests here in the U.S.
Right.
Once that faded out, they started covering Pennsylvania a bit more. Protests here in Pennsylvania and concerns raised by environmental groups in Pennsylvania, which should be pointed out, these are legitimate concerns. People, they're not inventing these things, but they are amplifying them.
So you've brought it to the stage of why we in Pennsylvania should be, your readers, our listeners should be interested. Several of the headlines lately sound legitimate, like they could have been reported from the perspective of environmentalists, not per se propaganda.
Right. And that's the thing. That's what makes it a little, you know, murky in a way, because these are legitimate stories. These are legitimate concerns. But the belief among many people is that they're being amplified for a specific purpose that benefits a foreign adversary.
Okay. Now, but the articles from RT, are they legit?
you know, the
are they made up or what?
Right. I tend to I tend towards the absolutist end of the First Amendment. So I would say, you know, that journalists report, and sure, journalists come at things from a certain perspective sometimes, and they're a little, you can have biased journalists who are trying to advance a certain interest. So they are, the stories are real. They're not made up.
Okay.
That's the thing.
All right. But there is a motive behind those stories.
If you ask RT, they say no. If you ask several other people, including members of the U.S. government, they say yes.
Okay. Now, do any local environmental groups feel that they're being used in this process?
Not that I spoke to, no. In fact, a statewide environmental group I talked to, the executive director said—
David
yes.
Mazur, right?
Yep. He said, you know, I'm not aware of this. And, you know, we don't need fake news to advance our cause. There is enough research out there. There is a large enough body of scholarship, and there is enough concern among people, legitimate concern, that we don't need Russia, you know, pumping this up. It should also be mentioned that Russia didn't just use RT. The same online trolls, the same social media groups that were involved in the 2016 election were also involved in boosting these protests on social media and in trying to inflame protests.
All right, just 90 seconds left. So at this point, do we know if Russia is doing more than influencing the media? Are they trying to block plans for pipelines, maybe a pipeline toward New England, as you point out in your story?
We don't know, but it certainly does seem that Russia benefits from not having that pipeline built. Russia does benefit because they last year imported a bunch of Russian gas into New England during that very cold snap. One other important point is that this also contributes to that discord. They want to delegitimize the United States political system. And by creating this discord and by hardening these lines between one side and another on any debate, be it race, be it energy, be it politics, they succeed when we look weaker. And they succeed when we look more divided, when it looks like our system is not working the way it should.
Investigative reporter Mike Warshak, and look for his story on Pennsylvania natural gas and Russia in the print-only newspaper, The Caucus, which covers government and politics. Thanks so much, Mike.
Always a pleasure.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Hope you didn't need to catch your breath following the May 15th primary election, because there have been some major developments since then in the race for governor, as Republican nominee Scott Wagner tries to unseat the Democrat incumbent Tom Wolf. On the line from Harrisburg is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer. Welcome to the program, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Katie, before we get into the significance of developments this week, we have two candidates who are similar in at least a couple ways, right? Both millionaire business owners, both from York County.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. both sort of a political outsider types. You know, Tom Wolf hadn't held political office before he became governor. Scott Wagner hadn't before he was elected to the Senate. So, you know, very similar people, but obviously very different approaches to the job.
Okay, and they like to still highlight that outsider, even though they are in elected office. Wagner was really only in the Senate a few years, is that correct?
4 years, yep.
Okay. Now, he resigned Monday from the state Senate to focus on his gubernatorial campaign. Was it a fond farewell? His speech seemed to have some conciliatory comments to it.
I would say it was interesting, actually. Wagner is sort of known, and I think he wouldn't contest this, as sort of a brash person. He certainly made some enemies for himself while he was in Harrisburg, also was well-liked, especially by conservative Republicans. So I think it was interesting, actually. During his speech, he gave basically, you know, a stump-style speech on the Senate floor, as is you know, customary for departing lawmakers. And he threw kind of a note in there saying, like, I know a strong personality, and if, you know, I've offended anybody, sometimes I've said things that I shouldn't maybe, and I apologize for that. So it was sort of an interesting note to go out on. And, you know, in remarks after Wagner spoke, the Senate Minority Leader, the Democrat Jay Costa, you know, I was, you know, wondering if maybe they would do sort of a rebuttal-type situation to, you know, Wagner's campaign stuff that he put in there, but it was really quite you know, polite and collegial. So the whole thing didn't seem bitter necessarily, but there was an apology worked in there.
And the difference of this farewell speech, as opposed to as compared to other farewell speeches of lawmakers, they tend to sort of highlight their accomplishments and say their thanks to their colleagues and so on and so forth. But you mentioned this one had a political looking ahead tone to it as well?
Yeah, totally. I mean, and you're going to expect that. The man's running for governor. But, Wagner kind of going back to basics, saying, you know, throughout his time in the Senate, he's been committed to, managing spending is what he always says, making sure that things aren't being spent frivolously, time is money kind of situation, good fiscal conservative talking points. He also did talk up some of the, bipartisan compromises he's managed specifically on, reforms, and this hasn't passed, but reforming prison-related thing to try to wipe records from certain former convicted people. So, things like that.
Okay, a quick one for you is, with 6 months or 6 months remaining on his term, did he get criticized at all for sort of leaving 250,000 constituents without representation?
Certainly, yeah. And you've seen that from Democrats, specifically the Wolf administration, saying he's sort of dipping out on his constituents for his own political aspirations. But then you see on the other hand, in the Senate, Senate Republican leaders said, no, we support him in this decision. It's, from their perspective, not good to split time between a campaign and serving constituents. So two minds with that, obviously, split very much in terms of party. Of course, you're going to get some discrepancies there.
All right. We have just about 90 seconds or so, sure. Katie. Do we have a sense of Wagner's strategy? You know, Wolf is obviously known statewide because he is the incumbent governor. Has Wagner's campaign indicated what they plan to do regarding stumping, maybe even this part of the state in western Pennsylvania, to get his name out there?
What we've seen this week is sort of a boots on the ground, like I'm a guy who can get things done approach from Wagner. He made a big point of cleaning up a Philadelphia park that he said the city was not dealing with correctly. So I think if we take that maybe as a tenor of where he's going, he may try to, be on the ground in various parts of the state. It's hard to say. It's early yet, okay. So it'll be interesting.
What about issues? Have any of them sort of focused on particular issues that they're going to emphasize during the next about 5 months?
I think Wagner, you get this with a lot of Republicans, it's going to come down on spending and, waste. There's a real concerted effort on his part to cut down on how much the government is spending, specifically, on social programs in a lot of cases. I think that's going to be the key issue that you see is the differences in opinion on spending.
It's going to come down to pocketbook then, you're saying?
I think it may, yeah.
Okay, I just want to get a quick answer from you. I haven't seen any negative Wolf ads against Wagner yet in this area. Are you seeing many commercials in the Harrisburg area?
I actually don't have cable, so I don't always see commercials, but I try to keep up on it. But not a whole lot. You're starting to see some. Definitely the Wolf campaign is going to be promoting Wagner as Trump-like in a negative way, saying, he's brash, he doesn't think before he speaks, things like that. So I think that's definitely what you can expect from them. But when it's going to, really hit the fan, hard to say.
All right, Katie Myers, WESA's Capital Bureau Chief, based in Harrisburg. Katie, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for our program is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.